Welcome to this week's reading from Sports Illustrated. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. And let's begin with a feature from Sports Illustrated's website, SI.com. This feature is entitled, Though Long Overdue, Dick Allen and Dave Parker Fittingly Enter the Hall of Fame Together. The two players endured racism and personal hardship during their time in baseball and dealt with it differently, but were appropriately elected to Cooperstown together by the Classic Era Committee on Sunday. And this feature is written by Sports Illustrated writer Tom Verducci. 47 years after he played his last game and 2 years and 1 day after he drew his last breath, Dick Allen is a Hall of Famer. 33 years after his last game and 12 years after a tremor in his right hand eventually led to a diagnosis of Parkinson's disease, Dave Parker is a Hall of Famer. Allen and Parker have a shared history, so it is right that they be enshrined together next summer. Both were among the best hitters of their generations who hit the ball so hard they were imposing threats in the batter's box. Both became the highest paid players in baseball, Allen in 1973 and Parker 6 years later. Both were managed at the top of their game by Chuck Tanner, a man who allowed them to flourish by treating them with respect when others did not. Both suffered open racial prejudices. Both endured waits for the Hall of Fame not so much different from their careers, long and difficult. On Sunday, the Classic Era Committee corrected long oversights by recognizing that Allen and Parker have been underappreciated all these years, especially during their careers. Parker was named on 14 of the committee's 16 ballots and Allen by 13 of them, clear favorites on a solid ballot. Of the maximum 48 votes, Parker, Allen, and third-place finisher Tommy John accounted for 71% of the most possible votes. Allen had fallen one vote short twice before. Over his first 11 full seasons from 1964 to 1974, he led the majors in OPS Plus. The players behind him, Willie Mays, Frank Robinson, and Henry Aaron. He swung a 42-ounce bat with viciousness. Allen spent 15 years on the writer's ballot and never pulled as much as 20% support. What hurt Allen was a reputation for disrupting clubhouses. In one six-year period from 1969 to 1975, Allen was traded 5 times. The statistician Bill James wrote 30 years ago, quote, "He did more than anybody else to keep his teams from winning, and if that's a Hall of Famer, I'm a lug nut, unquote. What most people missed or chose to ignore was the turmoil and the racism that Allen faced as one of the first black stars of the Philadelphia Phillies. In 1963, when Allen was 21, the Phillies assigned him to AAA in Arkansas. Allen, who grew up in western Pennsylvania, later wrote that he begged the Phillies not to send him there. He had never been in the South, and he knew Little Rock was a cauldron of racial unease. When he arrived for the opener on April 17, 1963, Allen was greeted by white supremacists picketing the ballpark. The Associated Press reported, quote, "The game was the first desegregated baseball game at Little Rock, and several hundred Negroes were among the crowd that watched Governor Orville E. Faubus throw out the first ball," unquote. Faubus was the same man who, 6 years earlier, refused to comply with Brown versus Board of Education and ordered the Arkansas National Guard to bar black students from attending Little Rock Central High School. When Allen joined the Phillies later that same year, he found more racial animus in his home ballpark and state. The Phillies were the last National League team to integrate. They fielded all white teams until 1957, exactly a decade after Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier, when they gave shortstop John Kennedy a brief trial. In 1965, Allen and white teammate Frank Thomas engaged in a clubhouse fistfight. The Phillies released Thomas, but many fans blamed Allen. Over the years, Allen weathered so much abuse from fans, including objects that they threw at him, that he took to wearing a helmet when in the field. Like Allen, Parker had to play through verbal abuse and flying objects, even in his home ballpark. The anger directed at him grew in January of 1979, coming off a second straight batting title and the MVP award. Parker signed a 5-year contract that paid him just under $1 million per year, making him the highest paid player in baseball. It was early in the free agent era, a time of rising salaries and concurrent rising resentment from fans. Parker became a target because, as great as he was, he's the best player in the world, Chuck Tanner said. Nobody is great all the time. Pittsburgh fans booed Parker. The same treatment was evident for Mike Schmidt in Philadelphia the previous season. In 1979, Parker's car was vandalized in the Three River Stadium parking lot. Three times somebody broke into his house. People sent him racist mail filled with epithets and telling him to go back to Black Africa. Parker kept those letters and postcards. "It gives me inspiration," he explained then. "When I am tired, I look at them," unquote. The next year, a fan at Three River Stadium threw a battery at him while he was playing right field. It came so close to his head, he heard it whoosh by. "You pay your money, you've got a right to do something verbally," he said after the incident. "But this, it's getting unbearable. If this keeps going, I can't continue my career," unquote. Meanwhile, Parker had demons off the field that would not come to light until the infamous Pittsburgh drug trials of 1985. Parker testified that he used cocaine from 1976 to 1982, sometimes facilitating access for his supplier to the Pirates clubhouse and airplane, By then, Parker's great skills were eroding. Parker averaged 4.6 WAR over his first 7 years, but fell to 0.7 per year over the next three after his MVP season. Quote, "I stopped using in the late part of 1982, Parker testified. I felt my game was slipping, and I felt it played some part in it," unquote. Parker played another 9 years. While he did not return to his elite late 70s prowess, in that second stage to his career, he made three All-Star teams, finished in the top five MVP voting twice, won his first RBI title, and became a clubhouse leader with the Cincinnati Reds, the A's, where he won a World Series in 1989, the Brewers, the Angels, and briefly, the Toronto Blue Jays. Teams kept signing Parker because he could still hit and he knew how to keep a team loose. Parker was a renowned wit who spoke his mind, such as the time when someone asked him about the Pirates possibly facing Montreal Expos left fielder Bill Lee. Quote, "Bill Lee pitching against us is like walking into a lion's den with a hamburger suit on," unquote, he roared. Allen and Parker dealt with the hostility directed at them in different ways. Allen was more of a loner who stewed after slights. He left the White Sox with 2 weeks left in the 1974 season because of a feud with a teammate. Though Allen won the home run title that year, Chicago sold his contract to the Atlanta Braves. He refused to report. He retired at age 33. The Phillies talked him out of retirement. He played three more seasons, largely as a part-time player. Parker was gregarious and outspoken, often the loudest man in the room and with a smile on his face. Allen and Parker waited too long to get their due, especially with Allen being honored posthumously and Parker battling Parkinson's. But it just seems right that when finally it did come, they were part of the same class. With this honor, those that never saw them play especially need to discover their stories. There is so much Allen and Parker share in how well they played baseball and how much they endured. And again, that Sports Illustrated feature is entitled, "Though Long Overdue, Dick Allen and Dave Parker Fittingly Enter the Hall of Fame Together," written by Sports Illustrated columnist Tom Verducci. And in another baseball feature from the Sports Illustrated website, this headline reads, "Roky Sasaki nears lifelong Major League Baseball dream as free agency sweepstakes begin." The 23-year-old Japanese phenom pitcher left a nine-figure deal on the table by coming to the U.S. now, and has his sights set on stardom as all 30 teams line up to make their pitches. And this feature, written by Sports Illustrated columnist Stephanie Epstein. When Japanese stud right-hander Roky Sasaki was a child, he dreamed of playing in the major leagues. The Major League Baseball stadiums, the crowds cheering in English, the jersey emblazoned with, well, he never got that far. "I asked him if he wanted to talk about the teams," says his agent Joel Wolf. "All he wanted to talk about was, am I going to be posted? When am I going to be posted?" Unquote. After much hemming and hawing, the Chiba Latte Marines, the Nippon professional baseball team that took Sasaki first overall in the 2019 draft, announced late last month that they would post Sasaki this winter, allowing him to sign with a major league team. Which major league team that might be is anyone's guess, including Wolf's. Quote, "What is important to Roki in making this decision?" Wolf asked rhetorically. "It's been a little bit difficult to really ascertain what his decision-making process would be for choosing a team because his focus has predominantly been on whether or not he's going to be able to post. The best I can say is he has paid attention to how teams have done as far as overall success, both this year and in years past," unquote. Wolf added that Sasaki has asked current and former major leaguers about weather, pitching development programs, and general comfort for a Japanese player. But Wolf said that his client just wants to play in the majors and does not yet have any one team in mind. Sasaki, who must sign by January 23rd or return to Chiba Lotte in Japan, will be the pitching prize of the winter. At age 23, and with perhaps the best stuff of anyone in the world, he would be coveted by all 30 teams under normal circumstances. These are not normal circumstances. If Sasaki had waited until he was 25, he could have signed a massive free agent contract, perhaps even one approaching the 12-year, $325 million deal that his countryman and fellow pitcher Yoshinobu Yamamoto inked with the Los Angeles Dodgers a year ago. But at Sasaki's insistence, he is arriving now as a player who is eligible only to sign a minor league contract, limited by team's international bonus pool money. Those figures range from $5.1 million to $7.6 million, a gap that Wolf called quote-unquote negligible and said would not be a deciding factor. So essentially, this is, as Wolf put it, quote, the draft in reverse, unquote. All 30 teams want and can afford Sasaki. He gets to choose. The last player who faced a similar situation was Japanese two-way star Shohei Ohtani, whose Nippon Ham Fighters posted him before the 2018 season when he too was 23. After reviewing presentations from most of the league, Ohtani selected the Los Angeles Angels. That was seen as a surprising choice at the time. The Angels were not a marquee franchise and had not won a playoff game since the year 2009, and indeed Ohtani decamped for the Dodgers when he became a free agent a year ago. But Wolf indicated that Sasaki might be open to a similar underdog. As Sasaki made clear to the team that he wished to be posted, a desire that some people saw as disrespectful to the Marines, some fans and pundits criticized him. Quote, "I think it's been a bit unfair, and it's affected him mentally a little bit," Wolf said. He added that there's an argument to be made that a small or mid-market team might be more beneficial for him as a soft landing coming from Japan, given what he's been through, unquote. Wolf is no dummy. He also added that he thought that Sasaki could handle a major market such as New York or Los Angeles. Sasaki has endured much more than negative media coverage. He grew up in Rikenzentakata, some 300 miles north of Tokyo, and he was 9 years old when the Great East Japan earthquake devastated the region in 2011. The resulting tsunami destroyed his home and killed his father and two of his grandparents. Sasaki has said that he found comfort in throwing himself into baseball. On the 12th anniversary of the disaster, Sasaki made his World Baseball Classic debut and led Japan to a 10-2 victory. It was during that tournament that the rest of the world learned about his fastball, which baffled major league hitters. His decision to leave Japan now may have cost him nine figures. It will cost the Marines tens of millions as well. They are eligible to receive only 25% of the signing bonus. Why come now, or last year as he initially hoped to, instead of waiting? Quote, there are no absolutes in baseball, and through Yoki Sasaki's eyes, there are no absolutes in life, unquote, said Wolf. And for the first time in his life, Sasaki will control his own future. Now he just has to decide what that will entail. And again, that feature is entitled Roki Sasaki Nears Lifelong Major League Baseball Dream as Free Agency Sweepstakes Begin, written by Sports Illustrated writer Stephanie Epstein. And from baseball news, let's turn now to some basketball news. The next Sports Illustrated feature is entitled Bond of Brothers. Five-star recruits Cameron and Caden Boozer have been looking out for each other and their older brother since birth. Next fall, they'll be sticking together when they attend Duke. And this feature is written by Sports Illustrated columnist Kevin Sweeney. The Cameron and Caden Boozer story begins at Emory University Hospital in Atlanta, where CeCe Boozer was desperate for a solution to help her baby, Carmani, who had been diagnosed with sickle cell anemia and was already experiencing dysplasia in his hands and feet. A doctor at Emory told her about the success that he was having using bone marrow transplants to treat sickle cell and added that the best chance for a bone marrow match would be from a sibling. CeCe and her then-husband, NBA All-Star Carlos Boozer, didn't want to risk having another child with sickle cell, so they went through the in vitro fertilization process, allowing them to choose embryos that were a bone marrow match and didn't carry the disease. Two embryos were a match, and both were implanted. Those embryos became Cameron and Caden, fraternal twins born in July 2007. 3 weeks later, Carmani had his transplant. He is now healthy and a member of the baseball team at the University of Fort Lauderdale, where Cameron and Caden grew up to become five-star basketball recruits, who announced in October that they would attend Duke next fall. The idea of I am my brother's keeper pretty much defines our family, CeCe says. That's who they have been since they were born, blessed to be able to take care of their brother, unquote. CeCe was intent on the boys forming their own identities, not only as more than a son of an NBA star, but also as more than the quote-unquote Boozer twins. They tried out soccer, baseball, football, even ice hockey, so basketball wasn't a fait accompli. And while Cameron and Caden were always on the same teams and were largely inseparable, CeCe made sure that they weren't the twins in matching outfits who got grouped together into one. They have fought for their identities their entire life, CeCe says. Even though they did everything together, I made sure that they were both allowed to be their own person, unquote. That individuality was especially important to Cameron and Caden as their basketball careers started to take off. The two were open to committing to different colleges, but ultimately decided to stick together after conquering the youth basketball scene like few others in recent memory. Ask Caden Boozer when the last time he and his twin brother had lost a tournament, and it takes a minute for him to remember. He pauses and looks into the air for a second and ponders. Eventually, the 17-year-old point guard phenom has his answer. He mentions a popular in-season tournament in Florida that his team from Christopher Columbus High School in Miami had lost the last two seasons, as well as an event that the Explorers had dropped in Arizona during the summer after his freshman year. Those results still eat at him, he says. The one thing that's hard to find on the Boozer twins' loaded basketball resume is losses. The brothers have won three straight state titles at a high school that had never won one before they arrived. They have led their AAU program to Peach Jam Championships, the biggest event of the summer, at the 15-under, 16-under, 17-and-under level, becoming the first team ever to sweep all 3 years. Cameron and Caden have each won two gold medals representing USA basketball on the international stage, first at the Under-16 Americas Tournament and then at the Under-17 World Cup Tournament this summer. And individually, Cameron has two Florida Mr. Basketball Awards to his name and a Gatorade National Player of the Year Award. The summer after his freshman year of high school, Cameron was invited to the NBPA Top 100 camp, attended by a number of NBA scouts and even a few decision makers in front offices. Despite playing against older players at just 14 years old, Cam shined at the camp, wowing college coaches and NBA teams with his polish and productivity at the forward position. From then on, scouts were paying extra close attention to the Boozers and the rest of the 2025 high school class, even if it meant watching 15 and 16-year-olds play instead of prospects far closer to the NBA. He was quickly pegged as a generational prospect and a likely high pick in the NBA draft, even if that draft was nearly 4 years away. Watching all the praise being heaped on his brother could have been hard for Caden, the smaller brother at 6'4", who wasn't anointed a future star as quickly. But Cece says that Caden handled his brother's smashing success with so much grace and positivity, and eventually Caden established himself as a top prospect in his own right. Few high school point guards control the floor like Caden does. He dictates pace masterfully, manipulates defenses with his eyes, and never gets sped up. He's an elite passer, leading the circuit in assists each of the last two summers, and his three-point shot has shown continued improvement. Plus, victories are a point guard stat in largely the same way they are a quarterback's, and no one has won more in youth basketball than Caden. He may not be regularly thrown around in number one pick conversations the way Cameron is, but his five-star status has been well-earned. I never really thought of it as I'm just the other brother, Caden says. I knew that I was a good player, and I've tried to become better each and every year. Thankfully, I've gotten a lot better since my freshman year, and I've gotten the attention that I didn't get before," unquote. Cameron isn't the first prospect to be labeled a future NBA star before he could drive, especially in the social media realm. Many stagnate in their physical development. Others get wide-eyed with their newfound fame and lose sight of what got them there. None of that has happened with the taller Boozer twin, who is 6'9". That's where the maturity of being raised around NBA stars comes into play. There's no sense that the twins have, quote-unquote, made it yet. Quote, "Being around a basketball family through the entire journey and continues to be in this business, you tend to look at things from a very different perspective," CC says. "I think a lot of people, especially in the high school journey, get really caught up in the hype of the moment. Cameron and Caden knew from the beginning that this is not the ultimate moment," unquote. Says Cameron, "There are a lot of players that plateau in high school. My biggest thing is not being one of those guys," unquote. Cameron has the drive of a budding superstar. His mom describes him as stoic and serious, not exactly the traditional adjectives to use for a 17-year-old. Without Caden, the loud and rambunctious twin, CeCe says that Cameron would probably never go to the movies or do regular kid things, unquote. He's already thinking bigger than just basketball stardom, saying that he is not doing the right things if he's only known for his on-court exploits, with sights set on making an impact on people with special needs and mental health issues before he's done. That personality translates to his demeanor on the floor. He is unflappable, if not almost robotic at times, with a quiet dominance. His game isn't designed for Instagram likes, though highlight reels of him and his brother taking over games do plenty well on the platform. There's little wasted motion, no drama, just production and wins. There's a comparison to be made between him and his father, long a no-nonsense guy whose numbers were louder than his highlights, though Cameron's ceiling is higher. Perhaps the best word to describe teenage Cameron Boozer is inevitable. Suit up against him and he will win, and likely tally 20-plus points and 10-plus rebounds in the process. In the inexact science of evaluating high school basketball talent, Cameron is as close to a sure thing as there is. And yet, right now he is listed as the number 2 player in his high school class in the 24/7 sports rankings, behind wing A.J. DeBanza. Does that bother Cameron? Not outwardly, at least. He rolled his eyes when his brother was asked to make the case for him as number 1 in the class, and when asked about it himself, he gave his own "rankings don't really mean that much" spiel that would make an old-school college coach proud. The external pressure and expectations will not fade any by choosing Duke, perhaps the college game's biggest brand. Plus, the twins will have to contend with the added pressure of walking in the footsteps of their father, who scored more than 1,500 points and went a combined 95 wins, 13 losses in 3 seasons playing for Mike Krzyzewski. That said, those accolades didn't mean this recruitment was always a lock for the Blue Devils. The decision came down to the wire between Duke and the twins' hometown school, Miami. Quote, What Carlos has done at Duke, of course it means something, but for us in terms of recruiting and going through everything, it didn't mean anything at all, Cameron says. Which isn't to say that the brothers aren't set on replicating their dad's accomplishment of leading Duke to a national championship. If that's not our standard, we're selling ourselves short, Cameron adds. Carlos filed for divorce in 2014, retired from basketball in 2017, finished his Duke degree in 2020, and now works as an analyst on the ACC network. He even interviewed his son's future coach, John Shire, during the network's coverage of ACC basketball media days, just before the Twins made their commitment to the Blue Devils. "I am proud of them," Carlos told ESPN. "They worked incredibly hard for this moment. They took their time and decided to play together in college, which is amazing. They complement each other so well. They made the best decision for themselves. Me and Mom could not be prouder," unquote. Staying together for college wasn't always guaranteed, but the brothers largely found themselves in agreement as they worked through their options. That was music to the ears of Cece, who jokes that she, quote, secretly had fingers crossed that the twins would stick together for one more stop on their basketball journey, unquote. But next year at Duke could be the last time that Cameron and Caden team up, at least for a while, given that they'll have no control of where they'll be drafted into the NBA. Quote, "Since I've always had my brother by my side, I've known that I can get through anything because I've always had someone I can trust," Caden says. "I won't be able to have that if we're not on the same team in the NBA, which is probably unlikely, but I'm going to savor these moments while they last," unquote. Before that last dance as twin teammates, Cameron and Caden will spend this year focused on cementing their high school legacies by winning a fourth straight state championship. Well, that and video games. Cameron, Caden, and Carmani are very invested in their NBA 2K My Career that they play together. "We're pretty good," Caden says. "We don't lose that often, I'll just say that," unquote. Somehow, that is not a surprise. And again, that feature is entitled Bond of Brothers, written by Kevin Sweeney of Sports Illustrated. And turning now to the scorecard section of this month's edition of Sports Illustrated, we see a headline essay, Sweet Spot. Arguably the most interesting man in television, Kelly Hayes is an extra set of eyes for Al Michaels. And this essay is written by L. John Wertheim of Sports Illustrated. Spotting Malibu Kelly Hayes? It isn't all that hard. You can catch him thundering through airports, usually connecting through Denver as he scrambles to catch a flight. With his spectacular shock of shoulder-length hair trailing behind him like a kite, you can find him running at 8,500 feet of elevation in the mountains outside his home in Aspen. Or you might find him on the slopes behind his home in his role as a media liaison for the Aspen Skiing Company. He takes visiting journalists skiing. And you could spot his handwork, a breezy and stylishly written wine column in the Aspen Times, which he has filed before deadline 893 straight weeks and counting. It was, of course, a beer guy who laid claim to the most interesting man in the world honorific. But at age 68 now, this Chardonnay Guy could challenge for that title. And we haven't gotten to Malibu Kelly Hayes' main gig, the reason why his name likely rings a bell, if perhaps a faint one. You won't necessarily spot him in the NFL broadcast booth. He's out of frame, just to the side of Al Michaels. But for 45 years and nearly 1,000 games now, Hayes' eagle eyes and quick fingers have enriched the viewing experience of millions of football fans. It's a form of quality control, says Al Michaels. What Kelly does, it's the kind of thing that viewers appreciate without knowing they appreciate it, unquote. We talk about the sports industrial complex and the jobs it generates beyond roster spots and coaching positions. The television spotter is a prime example. Who knew you could make a living playing sports bird watcher, identifying that double tight end formation or the second string linebacker who just made the tackle? From multiple levels above the field, Hayes arms himself with Maven brand binoculars and discerns plays as they unfold. In fractions of a second, he points to relevant numbers on his trusty chart, ensuring Al Michaels makes his call with accuracy. Hayes is something akin to a backup singer, anonymous but an essential part of the ensemble, solidifying the performance of the featured player. "He's my second set of eyes," says Michaels. "Normally, I can tell you who the ball carrier is or the receiver is, but who makes the tackle? Not all the time. I may need some assistance on that because the play gets marginally obscured with the naked eye or even on the monitor." What he's also able to do, guys that come in and out of the game, somebody gets hurt and is on the sideline. That's where he comes in, unquote. The spotter comes by it all honestly. As a kid growing up in, yes, Malibu, Hayes and his family had season tickets for Rams games just below the L.A. Coliseum press box. "I remember not just going to those games," he says, "but sitting with a pair of binoculars," unquote. At Palisades High, he put his powers of observation into practice, playing wide receiver on the football team. He caught throws from quarterback Don Burgess, who later became an Academy Award-nominated cinematographer. After Hayes didn't make the football team at Colorado as a walk-on in 1974, he transferred to Boston University. There, he studied communications, and for a senior project, he researched how ABC Sports covered games, meets, and matches. Through that experience, he was offered a job as stage manager when Don Drysdale and Keith Jackson called the 1978 winner-take-all play-in game at Fenway Park between the Red Sox and the Yankees when Bucky Dent hit his famous home run. Hayes, living in Kenmore Square at the time, was despondent, but he made sure that Jackson made it to the winner's locker room after the bottom of the ninth. At a PGA Tour event in Colorado, Hayes met George Hill, who had recently been anointed as Al Michaels' stat man. Hill had begun traveling to games from his home in rural Washington State to assist in the broadcast booth. Hill suggested that Hayes could flank Michaels on the other side in this newfangled role as spotter. When Hayes asked what the job entailed, the answer was slow and coming. Essentially, he would quote-unquote build a board for Michaels, an arts and crafts project, stuffed with easy-to-read information such as uniform numbers, heights, weights, draft classes for players on both sides of the ball. Ideally, Al Michaels would study the board before the game and then be able to refer to it during the broadcast. Hayes shrugged in assent. He built his first board, and a few weeks later, in the fall of 1979, he was standing amid 75,000 fans at a Penn State-Nebraska football game, asking for directions to the broadcast booth. "I was scared to death," he recalls. "I just followed the action, and I guess it all worked out," unquote. Yes, it did. And thus began one of the more unusual relationships in sports. 2 weeks after meeting in Nebraska, Hayes worked with Michaels at the 1979 World Series. But the overwhelming majority of their broadcast have been football games. For more than 40 years, Hayes and Michaels have had a weekly tryst at an exotic NFL location. 1 week it's New Orleans, the next week it will be Seattle. Michaels, and thus Hayes, has switched networks and nights and even delivery modes, having gone from networks such as ABC to cable such as ESPN and back to networks such as NBC. And now, in Michaels' current role with Amazon's Thursday night games, to streaming. Early in their relationship, Al Michaels, a longtime Southern California resident, began good-naturedly referring to Hayes as quote-unquote Malibu Kelly. As a matter of habit, Michaels often concludes broadcasts with words to the effect of, quote, "Thanks to the producer and the director and the rest of the team in the truck. And, of course, Malibu Kelly Hayes up here with me," unquote. Though Hayes and his wife Linda moved to Aspen more than 20 years ago, the Malibu nickname stuck. In 1996, for instance, Michaels did a pre-game interview with Cowboys coach Barry Switzer. At the time, Michael Irvin, the team's star wide receiver, was facing a suspension. When Michaels asked when Irvin would be eligible to come back to the building, Switzer replied, quote, "About the time that you thank Malibu Kelly Hayes at the end of the game," unquote. As an independent contractor, Hayes is paid by the game and has often held other jobs, including selling ads for Penthouse. He wasn't in Aspen long when the publisher of the local newspaper heard about his knowledge of wine and, on a lark, asked if he had any interest in writing about food and spirits. Thus began, quote-unquote, Wine Inc., a weekly column that covers new local vineyards to global trends. 1 week he might write about Western Colorado's underrated Cabernet Sauvignons. The next week it could be about Austrian Onofields spending $1 billion on an estate. Often he combines his NFL travel, say, to a 49ers game, with a wine reporting trip. And as he sees it, there's plenty of overlap between his two jobs / passions. Quote, "I see sports and wine as separate pursuits," he says, "but when you're into sports, you're into where people are from. You're interested in their stories. You're interested in their statistics. Same for wine. There's this base element at the core, the way information is being conveyed and processed," unquote. Among Hayes' personal highlights, conveying and processing, in the waning seconds of Super Bowl 34, Hayes wasted no milliseconds pointing out that Titans receiver Kevin Dyson was tackled at the one-yard line by St. Louis linebacker Mike Jones, preserving the Rams' victory. 15 years later, Super Bowl 49 may have marked Hayes' personal career MVP performance. In the waning moments of the game, Hayes noticed the Seattle Seahawks inexplicably declined to hand the ball off to Marshawn Lynch and instead called for a passing play. He then fingered little-known Patriots defensive back Malcolm Butler as the player who intercepted Russell Wilson's red zone pass. It's worth noting that, when asked independently, Al Michaels also brings up the same two plays. Quote, "There's that thousandth of a second where you say, did I screw this up? Then there's that affirmation where Kelly can point to it," unquote. Despite some close calls and some travel misadventures and many delayed flights, Hayes has not missed an assignment. Hayes has had to spring OJ style through airports. He's had to drive to Grand Junction, Colorado, 127 rugged miles from Aspen, and fly west before flying east. "One thing I will say about myself, I show up," Hayes says. And says Al Michaels, quote, "You know how FDR said we have nothing to fear but fear itself? Well, I have nothing to fear but Kelly Hayes not showing up for a game," unquote. And again, that essay from Sports Illustrated's scorecard section is entitled Sweet Spot. Arguably the most interesting man in television, Kelly Hayes is an extra set of eyes for Al Michaels, written by Sports Illustrated writer L. John Wertheim. And next, let's look at the Sports Illustrated Faces in the Crowd page, written by Dan Falkenheim. One of the faces in the crowd is Tessa Knapp, Knapp spelled K-N-A-P-P. Her sport, soccer, and her hometown, Bay Village, Ohio. Knapp, a senior forward for Bay High, scored 3 goals in a 7-0 defeat at Padua High to break the state career goal-scoring record. 1 week later, she scored twice in a 3-0 win over Notre Dame Academy to become the first boy or girl in state history to score 200 career goals. A Notre Dame commit, Knapp was named the Ohio Gatorade Girls Soccer Player of the Year as a junior. Another member of Sports Illustrated's Faces in the Crowd this month, Peyton Houston. His sport, football. His hometown, Shreveport, Louisiana. Peyton, a sophomore quarterback for Evangel Christian Academy, completed 53 of 68 passes for 817 yards and 8 touchdowns and ran for 2 scores in a 77-76 loss to Captain Shreve, breaking the state single-game passing mark and becoming the 3rd high school player ever to throw for 800-plus yards in a game. A 4-star recruit, he gained more than 400 combined passing and rushing yards in 5 of his first 6 games. Another face in the crowd, Ben Vombauer, sport wrestling, and his hometown, Greeley, Colorado. Vombauer, age 44, defeated Sweden's Jarko Wester 5-0 to win gold in the Greco-Roman 62-kilogram competition of the 41-45 division at the Veterans World Championships in Proech, Croatia. He also defended his 62-kilogram freestyle gold in a 3-3 win on criteria over fellow American Ben Kajar. Vombauer, who is the head coach of the Bear Cave Wrestling Club in Greeley, was a two-time All-American at Boise State. And this next face in the crowd is playing lacrosse. It's headlined On Duty. After leading the midshipmen to the NCAA Women's Lacrosse Final Four in 2017, Ingrid Boyum served as an intelligence officer in the Navy for 5 years. Once home, she thought back to her time on the USS Harry S. Truman when she would have done anything to be able to play lacrosse. That fueled her resolve to make the first U.S. national women's lacrosse team in 2023. This fall, the goalie started at the inaugural Women's World Box Lacrosse Championships and thrived with a tournament-high 0.88 save percentage in the final. She held Canada to one goal on 25 shots in the first half and shut out her opponent over the final 8 minutes as Team USA came from 2 goals behind to win gold, 10-7. Says Boyum, quote, "You don't have to have a golden path to get where you're going," unquote. And that's all the time that we have for this reading from Sports Illustrated. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for tuning in to this week's edition of Sports Illustrated. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info. And you could hear Sun Sounds on your smart home device.